Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 233, entitled Kevin Coogan's Conceptualization of the Order. Kevin Coogan is the brilliant author of the recent and vitally important book Dreamer of the Day, subtitled Francis Parker Yockey and the Post-War Fascist International. Kevin's book was published in softcover by Autono Media, copyright 1999. And this particular program, a half hour in length, is being recorded on July 2nd of the year 2000 for the benefit of people who hear it on tape. Now, Kevin Coogan's conception of the order is not to be confused with the Nazi organization from the 1980s of the same name, best noted for killing Alan Berg, but rather this is a hypothetical construct. I believe, in fact, that Kevin Coogan's conception of the order is a real concept. However, Kevin presents it as a working hypothesis. What the order is a post-war Nazi and fascist entity associated with the post-war Waffen-SS and involving ideas not only of fascism, but explicitly occult ideas of fascism with a political agenda. I would also note, for our purposes here, that in addition to working with elements of Western national security establishments, U.S. intelligence in particular, the order, this hypothetical construct that, again, I believe to be very real, also appears to have worked, as in fact has certainly worked, assuming that Kevin Coogan's conceptualization is accurate, which, as I've said several times, I believe it is, it also worked with the former Soviet bloc, so that basically Kevin's concept of the order, this construct, which I will from this point forward refer to as the order, worked with both Western national security establishments and the national security establishments of the former East Bloc, playing both sides off against the middle in order to realize a coming of a Fourth Reich or of a post-war fascist international, and that is what Kevin Coogan talks about. We're going to begin by taking a look at the work of Julius Evola. Julius Evola was an Italian fascist and occultist who worked with, among other organizations, the SD, the Seekerheitsdienst. We've spoken about Julius Evola in discussions with Kevin Coogan in For the Record programs 185, 213, and 221, among others. We've also talked about Julius Evola in connection with fascism and the black metal music scene in For the Record program number 222, also number 211. In Dreamer of the Day, Kevin Coogan talks about Julius Evola and his work with the SD, the Seekerheitsdienst, and presents his concept of the order. Kevin Coogan writes, Evola's SD work at the end of the war is shrouded in mystery. Historian Richard Drake says that while he was in Vienna, quote, Evola performed vital liaison services for the SS as Nazi Germany sought to recruit a European army for the defense of the continent against the Soviet Union and the United States, unquote. According to his own account, Julius Evola spent his time living incognito while doing, quote, intellectual, unquote, research. But what kind of research? While Evola was in Vienna, the SD supplied him with a series of arcane texts plundered from private libraries and rare book collections. The SD bureau that provided him with these documents was Amt 7, an obscure branch that served as an RSHA research library. With this precious archive, Evola closely studied Masonic rituals and translated certain, quote, esoteric texts, unquote, for a book called Historie Secrète des Sociétés Secrètes. It never appeared because Evola claimed that all his documents were lost during the Russian bombardment. But why would the SD, again that's the Seekerheitsdienst, the SS intelligence service, beginning again, but why would the SD actively involve itself in Evola's arcane research at a time when hundreds of thousands of Russian soldiers were sweeping into the Reich? And why would Evola choose to live in Vienna under a false name and devote his time to such a strange project? Could the answer to this question be found in the cryptic reference to Evola's, quote, efforts to establish a secret international order, unquote, in the 1938 SS report about Evola? I believe that Evola's Vienna project was intimately linked to the development of what I call the order, unquote, a new kind of Knights Templar designed to successfully function sub rosa. Well before the end of World War II, the intelligence and financial networks of the Third Reich were hard at work preparing underground networks to survive the coming Allied occupation. Escape lines to South America and the Middle East were organized. Bank accounts were created in Switzerland and other neutral nations to finance the underground with plunder the Nazis had looted from occupied Europe. But how was this secret empire to be managed, except by a virtually invisible, quote, government in exile, unquote? For years, Evola had been fascinated by knightly orders as expressions of the Kshatriya caste of warrior aristocrats. In the formal structure of the SS, he saw the precursors to a new Ordenstaat, a state ruled by an order. By the way, the Kshatriya caste refers to the second caste of the traditional Hindu caste system, the warrior caste. Continuing. He also understood the great advantages provided by medieval orders of chivalry due to their transnational composition. Crusading orders like the Knights Templar and the Knights of St. John of Jerusalem were pan-European, with separate, quote, national, unquote, sections, long or tongues, unified through a council presided over by a Grand Master. By the way, the Knights of St. John of Jerusalem is also known as the Sovereign Military Order of Malta, or Knights of Malta. That is spoken about in a miscellaneous archive show, a pair of half-hour segments that's available from Spitfire. That is based on a seminal work by Kevin Coogan called The Men Behind the New Counter-Reformation, the definitive work on the Knights of Malta. Continuing. After the collapse of fascist state power, a new order, an invisible college, unquote, of sorts, was needed not only to manipulate bank accounts and travel schedules, but to have policy-making functions. Nor could it simply be run under the auspices of the Vatican, since Evola believed that Rome's downfall had been caused by the acceptance of Christianity by the dominant faction of the Roman elite. The Emperor Constantine's official embrace of the, quote, gentle Nazarene, unquote, in 313 A.D., had culminated, 100 years later, in Alaric's sack of Rome. With the American chewing-gum imperialists threatening in the west, and the new Huns sweeping in from the east, was the situation in 1945 really so different? The Order was a vessel for those hermetic, unquote, elements of the conservative revolution, old ruling class, and new Nazi elite, not entirely beholden to the political, cultural, and religious GULF, G-U-E-L-F, wing of the European aristocracy, which remained ideologically loyal to the continued propagation of the ruling Christian mythology. The account of the origins of the order is obviously speculative, and I advance it as hypothesis, not fact. Yet, if I am correct, the SD really did have a need for Evola's unique talents. With his extensive knowledge of matters esoteric and occult, his fascination with secret societies and knightly orders, his Waffen-SS transnationalism, his ties to some of the highest figures in fascism, Nazism, and movements like the Iron Guard of Romania, and his loyal service to the SD, Baron Evola was a perfect candidate to help theorize a new underground order. As the SD's equivalent of Albert Pike, the former Confederate Army general who designed the rituals for the Scottish Rite Masons in the late 1800s, Evola's task was to help create the inner organizational and ritual structure for the Grand Masters of a secret Shambhala whose financial nerve center was carefully hidden away in Swiss bank accounts. Now, again, even though Kevin Coogan's concept of the order is speculative, as he underscores here, it's apparent from Kevin Coogan's text that the foundations for his speculation and hypothesizing here are entirely accurate, in particular the structuring of underground lines and financial networks of the Third Reich is a matter of public record, and in terms of the financial networks, obviously veteran listeners to this program will recognize what I have referred to in the past as the Bormann Organization, something, by the way, that is going to be discussed in For the Record program number 334 on the opposite side of this tape. Now, one of the things also that we have spoken about in the past and that will be to a certain extent reviewed here by Kevin Coogan is the fact that what I call the Underground Reich and what to a certain extent Kevin Coogan calls the Order. It should be noted that the Order here overlaps what I call the Underground Reich, but would not necessarily embrace the Underground Reich exclusively, nor would the Underground Reich necessarily embrace all of the Order. The Order would be a somewhat broader network than the Underground Reich, but would certainly include it. And I would say speculatively that the underground Reich and the Bormann Group would be the dominant element in the order through their financial and political control. Now, as I've noted in numerous archive shows available from Spitfire, the residua of the Third Reich's national security establishment went to work with the American national security establishment and intelligence system, among others. And as we've noted in RFA program number 37, the Galen organization continued to manifest the Nazi chain of command. Nazi spy master and Eastern Front Intelligence Chief Reinhard Galen continued to report not only to Admiral Dönitz, the political successor to Adolf Hitler, but also to General Franz Halder, his chief of staff, even while he was working with U.S. intelligence, thus indicating that the Nazi chain of command was still in effect and operating within the U.S. intelligence system, sort of like an HIV virus invading a cell. Note here that the order certainly appears to have worked directly with U.S. intelligence. Certainly the residua of the Nazi intelligence system and national security establishment did. And as we'll see later, this is very significant because they were also working with the Soviets and against the Americans and British. Turning once again to Dreamer of the Day, Francis Parker Yockey in the Postwar Fascist International by Kevin Coogan, we read, by the way, the strategy of tension here refers to a terrorist program in post-World War II Italy in which terrorism of the right and the left was manipulated in order to not only see to it that Italy remained in the Western camp, but also to curtail democratic rights when those democratic rights could be utilized by elements of the political left in order to move the Italian political establishment to the left. We've talked about the strategy of tension in, among other programs, Radio Free America number 19, also in numerous For the Record programs, and those are all available from Spitfire. Check the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com, SPITFIRELIST.com, for descriptions of the programs that are available. In particular, the For the Record sections, the For the Record programs, the half-hour segments, have mini article-length descriptions of each program that I've written and that will be quite useful to listeners who avail themselves of them. Even listeners who don't have access to the World Wide Web can go to a public library, and for the price of the paper, they will download the program descriptions, including the For the Record descriptions, which at this point would constitute something of a book in and of themselves. In any event, to the collaboration between the Order and Western Intelligence, Alan Dulles' CIA in particular, Kevin Coogan writes, "Behind the strategy of tension, there lurked what appears to have been a devil's pact between the Order and Alan Dulles. Until Dulles was named CIA director by President Eisenhower and his brother John Foster Dulles became Secretary of State, operational links to the Nazi underground came primarily from the Office of Policy Coordination, or OPC, headed by Dulles' protege Frank Wisner, the former chief of OSS operations in Bucharest, Romania. After the war, Dulles, Wisner, CIA counterintelligence chief James Angleton, and the OPC's Carmel Offi, OFFIE, virtually ran covert operations in Italy as their own private affair. The OPC's budget was $4.7 million in 1949. 3 years later, when Dulles was still only CIA deputy director, it had reached $82 million. OPC personnel had jumped from 302 to 6,954. OPC was officially incorporated into the CIA in 1952 as the agency's Directorate of Plans. In 1956, after President Eisenhower established the Killian Commission to investigate the agency, it was discovered that more than half of the CIA's personnel and 80% of its budget had been devoted not to intelligence gathering but to psychological and political warfare programs. Throughout this entire time, the Dulles Network was intimately involved in complex deals with factions inside the post-war SS. Did Dulles offer to protect elements of the SS in return for its support for CIA-backed anti-Soviet operations in Europe and the Third World? Did he think that granting the Order a certain amount of autonomy was a small price to pay for bringing it into the American camp? Might he even have been personally compromised in some way, or manipulated by the Dulles family psychiatrist, Carl Jung? Avila's men among the ruins, then, may have been less a concession by Avila to American power than a signal that some sort of understanding reached by Dulles and SS General Karl Wolff at the end of the war was now fully operational. Well, obviously that relationship between the residua of the SS and U.S. intelligence, among others, was operational. We've looked at that in numerous programs, including RFA 37 and a For the Record program called Odessa, Then and Now, about the post-World War II SS organization operating from memory. I believe that is For the Record program number 44. Certainly that can be verified on the website. By the way, Alan Dulles and John Foster Dulles, as we've looked at in numerous programs, were counsels with the Sullivan and Cromwell law firm. Frank Wisner, along with Harding Jackson, was also a powerful Wall Street lawyer. In fact, Frank Wisner and Harding Jackson were both deputy directors of Central Intelligence, and both of them alumni of Carter Ledyard and Milburn, which at one point did the legal work for the New York Stock Exchange, perhaps still does. Now, note here that there's speculation that Alan Dulles may have been personally compromised. That may have had something to do with his work with Sullivan and Cromwell. That, as we've looked at in numerous programs, did a lot of work for the Third Reich industrialists and also for American industrialists that backed the Third Reich. We've looked at that at Uncle Sam and the Swastika, For the Record program number 29. A four-part interview with John Loftus. We've also looked at that in For the Record program number 216, among others. In a miscellaneous archive show about the Nazi euthanasia program and the T4 program entitled Euthanasia and Reproductive Rights in Nazi Germany and Contemporary America, we also took a look at Carl Jung's work on behalf of the Third Reich. That is discussed here in a footnote that is included here by Kevin Coogan. Jung also treated Dulles' wife Clover for years. One of Jung's assistants, Mary Bancroft, was an OSS operative in Switzerland, as well as Alan Dulles' mistress. Like Avila, Jung was an expert in myth, symbol, and psyche, with a complex and ambiguous relationship to the Third Reich. Now, what's significant here is that in addition to working with Western intelligence and elements of the Western national security establishments, including and especially our own, whether or not Jung actually had a role in helping to bring the order into collaboration with Dulles and company or not, it should be noted that the Third Reich and the post-World War II Underground Reich not only made use of anti-imperialist sentiment among Third World liberation movements very successfully, but also was able to form post-war alliances with the Soviet national security establishment and elements of Eastern European and Soviet bloc national security establishments as well. Indeed, in the immediate post-World War I period, when both the fledgling Soviet Union and Weimar Germany were pariah nations, a pattern of collaboration developed between the German and so fledgling Soviet national security establishment, which perhaps could be thought of as having laid the groundwork for the post-World War collaboration, post-World War II collaboration between elements of the Soviet bloc national security establishment and the order, an element of the post-World War II Underground Reich, as I have termed it. And note again that anti-imperialist sentiment on the part of various Third World liberation movements in the Middle East in particular was successfully utilized by the post-World War II Underground Reich against the British, as it had been prior to and during World War II. We took a look at that in For the Record program number 216, among others. The Paulus referred to here, P-A-U-L-U-S, is in fact Jan Paulus of a Society for the Prevention of World War III that did anti-fascist research and warned about the East Bloc and Third World anti-imperialist connections of the post-war Underground Reich and the Order. Kevin Coogan relates this in Dreamer of the Day. In a January 28, 1953 internal memo, Jan Paulus wrote that, quote, Britain has been assembling quite a dossier on Nazi activities ever since May 6, 1952, the election in Lower Saxony. At that time, former Foreign Minister Herbert Morrison was much more perturbed than Britain openly revealed. Additional evidence in Churchill's possession reveals that the Nazi movement in Germany has reached tremendous proportions not only at home but abroad, since their tentacles reach Argentina, Brazil, the Middle East, and Far East, and even as far as Indochina, Idle thought number 174 from Dave Emery is, could that perhaps have had anything to do, ultimately, with American involvement in the tragic Vietnam War, which certainly split the United States and ultimately drove it in a reactionary direction and certainly weakened American society? Again, idle thought number 174. Continuing with Coogan's account here of relationships between the underground Reich and the East Bloc establishment, Paulus then reported that the British had uncovered the fact that two Russian generals, Bulganin and Kubalov, K-U-B-A-L-O-V, were working closely with the Nazis. They also found that the Russians had set up a counterpart to General Matthew Ridgway's Shape, headed by a General Shugaev in East Germany. That's capital S-H-U-G-A-E-V. The British had conclusive evidence, unquote, that the Werner Naumann circle maintained close ties to General Vincennes Müller, the brains behind the East German police. Paulus thought that Churchill wanted to use this information both to warn Washington that Germany was unreliable and to gain leverage over Adenauer, even to the point of being able to topple his government if necessary. He then said that, quote, Britain has an extremely extensive dossier about the Nazi activities, which she will reveal later in case Eisenhower decides to push his broad German policy too far. For instance, the British have conclusive evidence that the Nazi activities have been financed by the Ruhr industrialists, additional evidence that the Ruhr industrialists have been collaborating very extensively with the Nazis is the fact that when Dr. Hjalmar Schacht opened his bank in Dusseldorf, the Minister of Interior and Minister of Economics were present. The British particularly feared the Naumann Circle's astonishing influence in the Middle East. According to a March 1953 report by the Non-Sectarian Anti-Nazi League, or NSANL, Dr. Gustav Scheele, a Bruderschaft leader arrested with Naumann, maintained excellent ties to the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem. German corporations wishing to do business in the Middle East and Africa first had to approach Naumann, Scheele, Skorzeny, and the Grand Mufti. Scheele was especially close to Iran's nationalist leader, Dr. Mohammad Mossadegh, and supported Iranian efforts to nationalize Western oil companies. Three quick notes. Werner Naumann, who was named by Hitler to succeed Joseph Goebbels as head of the Third Reich propaganda ministry, was discussed in RFA 37 as leading an abortive coup to topple the Adenauer government in 1953. Haji Amin al-Husseini, the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, was an SS officer, a Nazi spy in World War II, wielded a lot of influence in the post-World War II world, and was the first leader of the Palestinian National Movement. Mohammad Mossadegh, of course, was overthrown in a CIA coup in 1953 in Iran and replaced with Dr. Fazola Zahedi, who also had been a Nazi spy during World War II. So that both with Mossadegh, the anti-British imperialist, and with Fazola Zahedi, the underground Reich had its finger in both camps in Iran. I would also note here, again, that Kevin Coogan's concept of the order worked both with the Soviets and with the Americans, and not really for either camp's political agendas, but rather for its own in order to use both sides against the middle. Kevin Coogan discusses the ideological utilization of both the Soviet and American blocs during the Cold War, and the fact that the root occultism, not only of the order, but certain other aspects of fascism, was one of the factors that dictated this ideological pragmatism or cynicism, some might call it. Again, it's important to understand that at the same time that the Underground Reich and what Kevin Coogan calls the order was working with our national security establishment, they were also working with anti-imperialist elements in the Middle East against the United States and Britain, and they were working with elements of the Soviet bloc against the U.S. and Britain. This is absolutely critical, and I think students of history and American political strategists should take this into account in evaluating not only the history of the Cold War, but the future. Kevin Coogan writes in Dreamer of the Day, there was, in fact, little ideological difference between Julius Evola and Francis Parker Yockey. Like Yockey, Evola believed that the American cultural threat to Europe was far greater than anything the Russians could come up with. His dispute with Yockey's Imperium was that Yockey had an overly superficial conception of what was immediately possible. Any purely secular interpretation of the divisions in the far right between the pro-Russian and the pro-American factions of the Black International that avoids the occult, unquote, would conclude that political differences divided the two tendencies. An order, however, is not structured along conventional political lines. Such an organization can dictate sharp turns and reversals in seemingly fixed political logics because the political, unquote, crudely understood, is not the motivating force. Whether Yaqui or anyone else tilted east or west, and at what time, and to what degree, and for how long, and under what conditions, was essentially a tactical question. The order, like any intelligence agency, was a kind of octopus with many tentacles, not just a left and right one. While I believe that there were legitimate policy arguments inside the post-war underground, as might be expected, I am not at all sure that it is meaningful to conceptualize a split inside the order along rigid east and west lines. An organization like the Order was necessary precisely to prevent the total domination of post-war Europe by either the Americans or the Russians in the view of its members. By playing off the U.S. and USSR against one another, the Order equally ensured its own ability to survive and prosper. In music, the basic theme can sometimes be quite simple. The real test is how well you play the complex variations. Indeed, and perhaps the future will dictate just what skillful composers the members of the Order, as Kevin Coogan conceptualizes it, in fact were. I've alluded to Spitfire. That's a tape duplication service which has the various tapes that I've put together over the years on file. That name is Spitfire, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E. You can reach them at P.O. Box 1179. That's Post Office Box 1179. That's in Ben Lomond, California, capital B-E-N, capital L-O-M-O-N-D, zip code 95005. Once again, P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, 95005. The email address is mail@spitfirelist.com. That's mail, M-A-I-L, at spitfirelist.com. Visit the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. That's SPITFIRELIST.com. One word, the SPITFIRELIST. That website is equipped with real audio, so you can listen to the half-hour segments going out to the various stations that carry this program the week they're going out. And again, there are descriptions of the various programs available from Spitfire, including mini article-length descriptions that I've written of the For the Record segments, so that listeners are strongly encouraged to get a hold of those and follow along on the website. There's also a list of the various programs available from Spitfire on the KFJC website at kfjc.org. Look in the transmissions and public affairs sections. That concludes For the Record program number 233, Kevin Coogan's conceptualization of the Order. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.